This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends. Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rout. Maureen, Deborah Challenor, who I interviewed over several years, historical fiction, New Zealand historical fiction, was quite amazing. It's really good. And she went off to Australia and now she's back. And she's going back to the book Fire, which she wrote in the, which is based in the 1950s. Didn't write it in the 1950s. And she's doing a link with that book and starting a series again, or
Her fans will be very pleased to hear that.
Yes, I was delighted. It's a great book. So
That's yours for this week.
Yes.
And my book this week is The Most Beautiful Gardening Book, put together by Christchurch photographer Juliet Nicholas and Barb Roger. Flourish is a wonderful new book of New Zealand women and their extraordinary gardens, and I'm very lucky to have both Juliet Nicholas, the photographer, and Barb Rogers, the writer, here in the studio with me because it's being launched in Christchurch. It's got the most wonderful cover of my favourite colour, orange.
Chosen for you.
Yes, and I know that that's a Christchurch garden. It will jump out at you if you're in the bookshop looking for something to buy for any woman of any age who loves gardens. So welcome to you both, Barb and Juliet. What an extraordinary job you two have had. You've just wandered from north to south to Stewart Island visiting gardens.
And the worst thing was stopping.
Yes. Well, there could be a flourish too, I guess. How did you go about sorting out which gardens you were going to use, and why did you decide to put a book together about New Zealand women gardeners?
Well, Juliet and I have been working together over the years, going back a long way, and I hesitate to say how long, but I've been in magazine journalism for a long time, specialising in gardening, and Juliet is a supreme photographer of gardens, so it was obvious that our paths would cross. But we didn't really... We didn't really have an idea for a book until relatively recently because we've both been so busy with our day jobs. And it was only when we met by chance in Melbourne at the Melbourne Flower Show, and we were both out of our comfort zone and, you know, I mean out of our work zone, in a comfort zone.
In a comfort zone,
yeah,
indeed.
And said, oh, God, we should be doing a book together. And so that's when it began.
Flourish is the result, but we really began a professional relationship back in the early 90s when Barb was editor of Urbis Landscapes, and we've worked with various titles ever since. So through that professional relationship, you naturally develop personal relationship.
Yes, indeed.
Know the person's work very well, and you know that you can work with them and get on with them. And we this professional relationship has developed into, through the course of these last 2.5 years, into a very close friendship as well. So it's been a great delight to travel around the country on a road trip for 2 years, on and off, photographing gardens. So with somebody you enjoy the company of. So it's been incredibly collaborative and enjoyable.
Yes, it sounds like the prize gig, doesn't it? Absolutely. And you two will have come across in your long experience a number of these gardens, and you also have the networks to ferret out other gardens. So were you in agreement about what sort of gardens you wanted to put in here? Were there any cases where you had to work hard to persuade the other person?
Well, we had we each came together with long lists, wish lists, and Juliet obviously knew Southern Gardens better than I did, and I knew of a lot more North Island gardens than she did. So we put the two lists together.
And the road trip enabled us. We went to all gardens together and then had the conversation about, will this work with the broader themes of the book? We wanted a diversity of types of gardens, and we wanted geographic spread. So it was really important to get north of Auckland and right to the south of New Zealand, west to Taranaki and east to Hawke's Bay. So
the important theme, though, of that is that we wanted the women to be able to tell their stories as well. So we were looking for women who had strong ideas and who were gardening at the top of their game, really. And it doesn't mean that it had to be a massive garden that everyone knew. I mean, and also the other thing was we asked gardeners, didn't we?
Mm.
We asked gardeners who we respected, who would you recommend?
Ah.
And so it was great. It was great fun.
One thing led to another.
Well, I was going to remark on the fact that what I enjoyed so much about it, apart from the abundance of glorious photos,
Hang on, Juliet's counted them. Do you want to know how many?
460.
Well, and that's precise. The ones that were chosen.
Exactly.
Not the ones that were shot. But I was what intrigued and engaged me was the stories of the women, and the way that you've captured who they are, their personalities and their loves and their hates, and the sort of, how many of them have taken these gardens on from scratch. Others have embellished what was there. Some have grown beyond their garden perimeters.
All quite different, aren't they?
Very
that's
much.
That's what we were aiming for. But we were very privileged that these wonderful women let us into their lives. It's kind of vulnerable. You're vulnerable in a way because we ring up and say, "Oh, we've heard you've got a bad garden. May we?" Or we just go look, and then they say, "Yes, you can." And then you think, "Well, they would have been working like mad before we got there and made sure it looked perfect." It was quite an invasive thing on our part.
Of course it is. The gardens for these women are extensions of who they are.
Exactly. And that is one of the keys to the book, that the personality and the person shines through not only Barb's wonderful words, but also
with the photographs as well, because you've carefully chosen photographs. There's wonderful shots of the gardens in all weathers. You must have had fun going back and catching a misty morning or a frosty morning. But there's also these lovely little close-ups of the various plants and flowers from
and
the gardens.
That was very important to both of us too. So the portrait of the woman is always the first image in each story, so that sets the tone, and you know whose garden this is really just by looking at them before you start reading the words. But we also wanted to contextualise the gardens and say where they are. So you've got Janet Blair's garden down in Arrowtown, with the magnificence of the Remarkable Range and that whole valley that she gardens in, and all the associated weather patterns that occur there, or to Lynn Barnes's garden in central Auckland, which is surrounded by motorways and concrete sort of overpasses and things like that. So context, whatever it is really important, because it helps define the garden.
It surely does. And for me, I talked about the cover of the book, which is Robin Kilty's glorious little garden here in Christchurch, which has gone through earthquakes and been restored. And she packs so much joy and colour and variety into that tiny little patch, doesn't she?
She certainly does. And it's a garden that changes all the time. So I was around there yesterday, actually, and I saw things that I had never seen before in the garden. So every week or two, something's changing in most gardens. But with Robin, she's very aware of succession planting and having interest all year round, actually. And so it's a pleasure whichever week you go to see something. And it's exuberant and happy with these vibrant colours, and the house is painted to work very harmoniously with the garden.
I think of her garden as the comeback garden.
Yes.
Because it was completely trashed in the quakes. And she couldn't live there for a long time. But she gathered strength with her friend Penny Zeno and developed an interest in the new perennial movement. And together they went over to
Piet Oldorf at Hummelo in the Netherlands. Mm.
And came back with those ideas, and Robin's applied them, and her garden, and Penny has as well. But I think the other thing that we would like to say about choosing our gardeners is that they're all hands-on gardeners, and that's why we've got them photographed with their favourite tools. And they're not prima donnas. They're out there every day, and we're just in awe of what they've achieved. Actually,
we are, and feel very privileged at the same time that we can combine these two passions of our respective trades of writing and photographing with our other passion, gardening. So
yes, indeed.
Lucky.
Well, there's so many gardens in here that we couldn't begin to. I mean, people have just got to go out and buy it. It's quite simple. No question about that. And I just have to end by saying another of my favourites in here, although why should I choose a favourite, is Rosa Davidson's wonderful garden. I'm talking about southern gardens at the moment, obviously, that people could possibly go and see. Up in the Marlborough coast, dry, arid, windswept, and what coast. She's done there just with natives.
Mm. Well, it was an eye-opener for me. Native plants are often used in gardens nowadays. We found that they're no longer a novelty as they used to be. So our gardeners are using them in a rich palette of plants. But Rosa's turned it on its side in a way. She decided to plant native-only garden, but using the classic European design style. And it's the most... it's the most exquisite garden, isn't it?
It is, and she has thousands of Nao trees in that garden and has grown most of them from seed. So it's been a long-term...
Yes, it shows that you don't
driven
actually...
Driven by a vision.
Yes, have to have stacks of money to get your garden going. Mm. Well, thank you both for all the work and love that you've put into this remarkable book. The photos and the text are married so well together. It's a joy to read. And as I said, I think it's going to fly out at the bookshops for Christmas.
Thank you very much. And thanks too for Penguin Random House for supporting these ideas and allowing us to go on this road trip for 2.5 years
and
visit these women and produce this book.
Well, we'll look forward to see what you do next. The book is called Flourish, New Zealand Women and Their Extraordinary Gardens. It's by Juliet Nicholas and Barb Rogers and published by Godwit.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9. Congratulations to Deborah Challenor. She has been awarded the member of the New Zealand Order of Merit this year for services to literature and historical research. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello, thank you.
And I was delighted that, as well as I was really thrilled that you had the honour bestowed upon you, but I was also delighted to receive From the Ashes, your latest novel. And that's going back to the 1950s. That was a special time for you, wasn't it, with Fire was produced that year? In that decade?
Yeah. So that was set in 1952-53, and this one picks up again with a lot of the same characters in 1955.
So what made you think of doing that? Why is the 1950s so special?
It was a time of great change for New Zealanders, as it was for Western countries around the world, those characters have stayed in my head, like my characters always do. And I've always wondered what happened to Ellie and her boyfriend, Sonny, and various people after the fire. So it just made sense to keep writing about them, really.
Yes, because it seems quite a long time ago that they've always stayed there.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. So this is the first, or this is the second, really, because it's a sequel to Fire, and you're also doing a quartet. It'll become a quartet. So let's talk about the 1950s. What were some of the changes that you noticed? Because I was leaving school in 1952 to go to Dunedin, to university, and I didn't really feel those changes at all.
No, we look back, I think, as New Zealanders at the 50s as a golden era, and I'm not 100% convinced that it was. We look back and we see these images of women in their kitchens and their high heels doing baking and that sort of thing, but I actually think it might be the beginning of the women's movement. Women went to work during the Second World War, but they were sort of shoehorned back into the kitchen after the war finished. But I think a lot of women didn't actually want to go back.
And didn't go back, did they?
Didn't.
No.
So I think about 30% of women actually stayed in work after the Second World War. But yet we still had these social constrictions on women. It was a very sexist time. There were these issues of... we had the issues of the Bethany homes where young women were sent due to a lot of social pressure from their own families and you know wider social pressures to go away, have your baby and don't come back with it. And that's an issue that's looked at in the book. Women weren't encouraged to go back to work, but a lot had to because there was quite a lot of poverty still in New Zealand at the time. Like, we think everyone bought a fridge and everyone bought a washing machine, but by the end of the 1950s, only half the population could afford a fridge because they were so expensive.
That's right.
And there's the issue of race relations. Like, I think I read somewhere official that New Zealand had the best race relations in the world. Well, we might have, but it still wasn't good enough. I mean, there were still signs outside barbershops, and so there's that whole issue as well. There was a really poor treatment of people who had mental health issues. So I have a little look at that as well. So, you know, it's nowhere near as golden as we like to think.
No, well, it was fairly ordinary for me because I didn't come up against those things very much. I was probably leading quite a sheltered life then, but it wasn't until the 60s that a lot of those things became apparent to me. When I really got into the real world, teaching.
Yeah, and a lot of people didn't see those things because they were living comfortable lives, and people did have comfortable lives. But if you're at the bottom, if you hit the wrong end of the stick, it could be very difficult for people. And there are a couple of families in the book who migrate to the cities. They're Maori families, and they do experience these unpleasant situations. I mean, I don't... In my books, I don't sit down at the beginning and think, what social issues will I write about in this? I just tell a story, but by the end of them, these things come out, and they're based on what I find in my research. So,
and that's really valuable research too.
Yeah.
So let's remind people about Ellie and Ellie Manaya and Sonny. That you've got three families, three stories, haven't you, in this book, really, that gradually sort of complement each other and come together. So what has happened to Ellie since Fire?
So Ellie and Sonny have married, much to a lot of people's disapproval. Ellie's parents weren't that keen because they were aware of the disapproval about mixed race marriages, and I hate that term, mixed race, but it was a term that was used at the time, and Ellie does cop a bit of trouble People look down on her because she's married a Maori bloke.
Who's absolutely wonderful.
A fabulous guy, yeah. Mm. And not only from her mum, but from his mum, you know, because she doesn't think it's going to work that well either, but it does work really well. And Ellie comes across, you know, a particularly snotty woman called Kathleen, who comes from the family that we last saw in Blue Smoke, who sets out to stick an oar into the marriage because has very racist ideas and just can't bear the idea of someone else being happy because her own marriage is such a disaster. And, you know, she comes from a lot of money and has a sort of marriage that should be working really well but isn't. And there's all these sorts of dynamics going on. And, yeah, so we have poor people who have fantastic marriages and rich people who have rotten marriages.
And then there's Polly Manaya.
There's Polly, who has a dreadful, dreadful secret that we don't find out about till the next book, but that colours all her behaviour. And who has a little child, and she can't look after her because of her lifestyle, and the child lives with Polly's mother, Afi. So we're left wondering, why can't Polly look after her, or why won't she look after her? It's obvious in this book that Polly loves the child. Yeah.
It's right. But pretty hard to be an unmarried mother.
Yeah.
And thank goodness she had a good grandmother.
Well, yes.
Gina.
Yes.
Mm. So, so there's a lot of what I saw in this book, there's a lot of smoking going on. Everybody smokes, don't they? Which kind of we've forgotten about how much that went on in that time, because you wouldn't find that anymore, would you?
No, everybody lit up, including the women, except they didn't do it on the street because it was considered common.
Right.
Smoking and eating on the street was considered common as well.
I was also glad that you brought in two older characters, Jack and Rose. Tell me about them and how they fit in and why you did that.
Rose is the matriarch of Ellie's family. She's... Colleen, who is Ellie's mum, she's Colleen's mum, and she's Irish and immigrated earlier. And it's about the end of Rose's life as well.
And there's also Jack.
And Jack, yeah, who suffers from what was known then as senile dementia. And, of course, nobody really knew much about senile dementia back then, and there were no support systems, and he is Anna's father-in-law, and Anna comes from I won't go into the whakapapa because I'll be here all year.
There's a myriad of characters, and what I love about your writing is you're a great storyteller, Deborah, and they all sort of come in, you know, they all mix in together eventually. Yeah. And at the beginning, they don't seem to be, you know, who's related to who. I have to kind of think about that. But it all develops. And do you plan that much?
I do. I do really detailed outlines at the beginning because do a lot of my research then to make sure it's all going to fit in historically and the story arc is going to work. And also because I always get lost in the middle of every single book, and if I don't have a detailed outline, I'll just sit there for weeks.
Oh, that's reassuring, because I had to go back once or twice to make sure I was connected to the right character and the right family that I was reading about. So another wonderful historical novel from Deborah Challenor, From the Ashes. It's a captivating story of family and friendship through one decade of incredible change, the 1950s, and it's published by HarperCollins.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.